This is the third Sunday after Pentecost. And on the first Sunday after Pentecost, which was Trinity Sunday, we heard the commission of Jesus to his disciples, go into all nations and make disciples. And then on the second week of Pentecost, that was last week, we had Jesus appointing 12 of his disciples to be apostles, to be sent out and to cleanse the lepers and heal the sick and cast out demons and even raise the dead. And then this week, the third week after Pentecost, we have Jesus speaking about the cost of discipleship, what it means to be a disciple. And this, along with our Old Testament reading, are two quite challenging readings, I think, quite hard to hear. The Gospel begins by telling the disciples that, you know, the disciple is not above the teacher, the slave is not above the master. And it's echoed in John's Gospel, where Jesus says to them at the Last Supper, if they persecuted me, they will persecute you. If they kept my word, they will keep yours also. The sense in which following Jesus is about following Jesus on the road of sacrifice and suffering. That's challenging enough. But he says to them, have no fear. Do not fear those who can kill the body, who can persecute you in this earthly life. Fear rather the one who can destroy both body and soul in hell. That sounds a little bit unsettling to my ears. And yet, immediately, he then says, are not two sparrows sold for a penny? So he gives them a word of reassurance. And it makes sense, doesn't it? Do not fear those who can only kill the body, they can only end this life, which is bad enough, but they can do no more after that. They have no power over us. And this has been a source of encouragement, of giving Christians courage down through the centuries, although we may still quake in our boots at the thought of martyrdom or even persecution. So following Jesus means following Jesus, and yet he says, have no fear, and reassures them and us that we are worth more than many sparrows. He then goes on to say that everyone who acknowledges him before others will also be acknowledged by Jesus before the Father. And conversely, those who don't acknowledge him, who deny him before others, before the world, he also will deny. And again, this sounds a little bit harsh to my ears, a little bit intransigent. Where's the mercy? Where's the compassion for our weakness? Lord, you know that we cannot stand as witnesses for you. And yet, it strikes me that when we interpret the who acknowledges me before others is not simply acknowledging Jesus in some abstract sense of being the Christ, however that is to be interpreted, but rather we're talking about Christ who is the truth, Christ who is the way, the truth, and the life. And that somehow when we deny truth, then the truth denies us. When we turn from the truth, then the truth no longer resides in us. We cannot have it both ways. And then he goes on to say, do not think that I've come to bring peace on earth. And yet, surely this is the Prince of Peace we're talking about. This is the one who came to the disciples after he had risen from the dead and said, peace be with you. He's the one who said to them at the Last Supper, peace I leave with you. My peace I give to you. I do not give to you as the world gives. I do not give to you as the world gives. In other words, this peace of Christ is a different kind of peace that is simply the uneasy peace of unspoken conflict, the uneasy peace of détente, the uneasy peace even of tolerance. I'll tolerate you, but no more. This is a peace that goes deeper, a peace the world cannot give. And yet here he says, do not think that I've come to bring peace to the earth. I've not come to bring peace, but a sword. And then he talks about these intergenerational divisions. A man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. Interesting that it is intergenerational. It's almost as if, you know, the old order is passing and the new order is arriving. Of course, last week we did hear him say, brother will betray brother to death. So there is a sense in which even within the generations there is conflict. And some of us may be able to testify that being a follower of Christ or standing for the truth, which I kind of equate in a way, we can have a discussion about that, gets us into trouble, even within our own families. And some of you can probably testify to that. There is this relative who won't have anything to do with us because of the stance we've taken on truth, on a matter of faith. And of course, there's this other relative over here who's gone the other way. They've become a raving fundamentalist. And they won't talk to us either because we're tainted. You know what I'm talking about. This division does occur. And then he says, whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Whoever loves a son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Whoever does not take up the cross and follow me is not worthy of me. And again, this sounds a little strange to my ears. Who is this potentate who is saying that you have to be worthy? Surely this is the Christ who knows that we're not worthy, and we know we're not worthy, and we depend on his mercy. So what does he mean here by saying he's not worthy of me? Who is the me that's been talked about here? This is hard for us to hear because we do put so much importance on family. If we think of our children, our grandchildren, we love them more than words can say, despite what they do sometimes. And yet here we're saying, well, yes, but if you love them more than me, then you are not worthy of me. What is being said here? What is the challenge to us? Again, I reinterpret the me as not simply being a historical person or even a mythical person called Jesus, the Christ, in an abstract sense, but rather that we're talking about love incarnate. That God is love. And all the fullness of God dwells in Christ and is made manifest to us. And therefore there's a sense in which if we love our children or our parents or anyone more than love itself, somehow it seems contradictory. And the challenge to us, the challenge to me this day, is what is it in my life that I love more than God, who is love, that somehow stunts me, somehow holds me back from the fullness of life that God promises? And as I say that, I think to myself, probably, a lot of the time, it is unconscious. That with my conscious mind, I want to follow God. I want to worship the God who is love. I want my life to manifest that way. And yet, so often in life, I find, that what we say or do doesn't necessarily match up to our aspiration and what we believe and the path that we want to walk. And I guess it's at times when we have to ask ourselves that question that perhaps the spirit within us will bring to mind those things where we think, well, here's a concrete instance. What are you going to choose? And how is love best served in this situation? In our Old Testament reading, we hear of a family tension, to say the least, as ancient Israel seeks to make sense of its own origins, seeks to tell the story of where they came from. We have the story of Abraham and Sarah. And last week we had that mysterious visit from the three who came to Abraham and Sarah at the Oaks of Mamre and said that Sarah was going to have a child, and she laughed because it was improbable, unlikely. And yet she did have a child, and she named him Isaac, which means laughter, because he brought joy and because she laughed, ironically, at the annunciation of his birth. But before Isaac came, and before the three visitors came, Abraham had already had the promise of a child and to be the father of many people. And when the child didn't come, Sarah had the bright idea of, well, why don't you sleep with my servant Hagar? And so he did. And lo and behold, Ishmael was born. So they had sought to force God's hand, or help God's hand, perhaps you could say. Or perhaps they worked on the basis that God helps those who help themselves. I don't know. But then, of course, Isaac came. And when a child was weaned, so I'm guessing about 1 year old, then Sarah sees Ishmael, who's a bit older, playing with Isaac. And she's threatened. And she says to Abraham, I don't want this child of the slave girl to inherit along with my son. Of course, not so long ago, it wasn't the child of the slave girl. It was her child that the slave girl had had on her behalf. And she says to Abraham, send him away, send them away. And we come to the first of the two verses that I think are particularly poignant in this story, where it says, the matter was very distressing to Abraham on account of his son. It's a quite dispassionate account, and yet every so often, glimpses of emotion and tenderness break through, and this is one of them. Israel is trying to make sense of its origins and is being honest about it and recognizing that where they have come from isn't necessarily completely free from taint of sin and of self-interest and of division and all of those things and exploitation. The matter was very distressing to Abraham on account of his son. Yes, it would be. And yet, as the story goes, as Israel tells the story with hindsight, and with hindsight means with interpretation, God speaks to Abraham and says, don't worry about it, I've got it covered. I will look after this child too. So Abraham puts the child on his mother's shoulders, gives her a skin of water, and sends her off into the wilderness, which apart from that word of God, is sending them off to their death. And we hear what happens. The water runs out, she leaves the child under the bush, she retreats a distance away because she cannot bear to watch him die. And we hear the second poignant verse from this passage. As she sat opposite him, she lifted up her voice and wept. lifted up her voice and wept. And in my mind's ear, I hear the weeping of Hagar and of all the Hagars, all the mothers who have had to stand back and watch. But again, as Israel tells the story with hindsight, with interpretation, the angel of the Lord appears and speaks to Hagar. Don't worry, I've got it covered. And so she searches, and water is found, and things unfold. But that's not the end of the Hagar story. We only get a glimpse of it here. And it's almost like a footnote, except the important thing to notice is this is Israel telling the story of its own origins. And it doesn't spare the elements of compromise and corruption and injustice that went on in their own origins that have brought them to the place where they are today. It's not a sanitized history. But there's more to the story. Even within biblical tradition, there's more to the story. We hear that Isaac's son, first son, Esau, the brother of Jacob who became Israel, marries one of Ishmael's daughters. So there's still that family connection. And in the Quran and in Islamic tradition, we hear more of the story, again, told with their hindsight and with their interpretation, that Hagar, called Hajar, was sent out into the wilderness. And she ends up at a place called, guess what? Makkah. And the story is enacted there. And she searches for water, and she runs between these two hills. And the seventh time of running between the two hills, a spring of water bursts forth. And that's when she gives Ishmael a drink. And the tradition is that he is the father of the Arab people, and she is the mother of the Arab people, from which the Palestinians take their origin, and the Muslims see her as the mother of Muhammad way back. And the story goes in Islam that Abraham continued to visit Hagar and spend time with Ishmael, and that the two of them built the Kaaba at Makkah, and that when people go to Makkah on Hajj, on pilgrimage, they reenact the walk or run between the two hills seven times to remember what Hagar did. And it is believed that Hagar and Ishmael are buried at Mecca, right beside the Kaaba. In non-biblical Jewish tradition, we also see of Hagar appearing later in the story of Abraham. In that tradition, Hagar goes to live with Abraham after the death of Sarah. That Isaac goes and gets her. Now, we don't know whether all of that really happened. We're just given little glimpses of history, possible history. The Palestinians see the story of Hagar as being reenacted, even perhaps fulfilled, with the expelling of the Palestinian people from Israel, when the State of Israel was founded in 1948. And so there's a sense in which what we're seeing here in this family feud is simply the feud that occurs between peoples and the tensions that are between peoples. over and over again, not just between Palestinians and Israelis, but certainly between them. And it's an honest telling of the story of origins, an acknowledgement that all that went before was not free of injustice. There were regrettable things that happened. There were things that if we could go back and change them, we could, but we can't. Therefore, the mandate for us in those situations is to recognize where we are today and to give thanks for that, yes, acknowledging the questionable journey that has brought us to this point, but committing ourselves to justice, to right the wrongs that have gone before, to right the wrongs that still exist. I wonder if you've spotted the link yet with our celebration of 150 years of Canada. We celebrate this great country and this great life that we have. As an immigrant, I am grateful to be here. This is my home now, as it is your home. And yet, even as we celebrate and give thanks, we must not allow ourselves to ignore some of the questionable twists and turns in our story. Because if we do that, then essentially we are denying the truth. And we are denying love. And therefore we find that the truth does not reside in us and among us. And we are not worthy of love.